Topic 1. Conscientious Objection to a Particular War. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, bringing you the 13th in a series of civil liberties educational programs produced by MCLU as a public service. Recently, the National Board of the American Civil Liberties Union adopted a comprehensive statement on war issues, dealing with the problem of military conscription, conscientious objection to a particular war, and the presidential preemption of Congress's power to declare war. The National Director for Development and Membership of the American Civil Liberties Union, Gordon K. Haskell, was in town recently to meet with the MCLU board. Tonight we have an interview with Mr. Haskell on the national position of ACLU and myself with interviewer Marvin Granger.
Recently, the problem has been increasingly urgent concerning those who object to a particular war, which they consider to be unjust or immoral. Recently, the National Board of the American Civil Liberties Union declared that conscientious objection to a particular war is a right of conscience which the draft law should honor. With me today are Gordon Haskell, Executive Director of the Membership and Development for the National Civil Liberties Union, and Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Haskell, this statement issued by the National Board of ACLU is a very long statement, about 3,000 words, I believe. Could you tell us briefly what brought the board to issue this statement and what the crux of it is?
The ACLU was born, in a sense, around the issue of conscientious objection to the First World War. The committee, there was a committee for conscientious objectors, which later after the war became the American Civil Liberties Union. So the problem of conscientious objection is not a new one to us. But for a long time, we were content to argue over the particular issues of this or that claim to conscientious objector status. Only now, in 1965 and 66, are we confronted with a situation in which a large number of young people are saying that although they don't have conscientious objection to all wars, that there are wars in which they would be willing to fight and die for their country and for principles which their country is fighting for. The present war in Vietnam is different, that it offends their moral sense, it offends their deepest ethical feelings about what this country means, about the meaning of America in our civilization, that this intervention they regard to violate their personalities and that they will not participate in it. The problem for the American Civil Liberties Union was, are we going to give legal defense to people who are not claiming the old traditional grounds of general pacifism, but who say that they have the same kind of moral revulsion to participation in this war as a pacifist has to participation in all wars? There are other problems which we have had to face also, and that is the general problem of the institutionalization of conscription in American society. There were times when, in times past, when people left Europe and came to this country precisely because they did not want to serve in the conscript armies of Europe. And America, one of the things that America stood for was that we did not have conscript armies in this country. In the Second World War and the First World War, we had conscript armies, but that was soon abolished after the First World War. Now we've had for over 25 years general military conscription in one form or another becoming part of American institutionalized life. So the Civil Liberties Union took a look at this also and tried to come up with a concept as to whether this idea of military conscription should simply be accepted as part of our society, whether the Civil Liberties Union should investigate and look into the conditions which the government claims compel conscription, and to oppose it or to urge the disestablishment of conscription as part of the American way of life in connection with a particular claim by the government that we need it now. And finally, we were also asked to look into the question of the conduct of a major war by the United States without a declaration of war by the Congress. And some of our branches, particularly our Ohio Civil Liberties Union, felt that there is a grave constitutional issue here. Can we ask young men to go and die in a war where the requirements for war in the Constitution have not been fulfilled? So all of these problems came to a head at a national board meeting at the end of January, where we had representatives from our 36 affiliates in all parts of the United States, and we tried to wrestle with them, and it was not an easy job, I must say, because the issues are extremely complicated. On the question of military conscription, all we could say is that there's no doubt that nothing deprives people, except imprisonment perhaps, for crime, of their generally accepted civil liberties as to be taken away from their occupations and their homes and the freedom of choice which an American citizen considers his birthright, and put into a military establishment for 2, 3, or 4 years or whatever it may be, in circumstances where most of the generally accepted rights just don't apply or they're greatly circumscribed. And all we could say is that the government must bear the burden of proof that this is needed for the national defense, for the survival of the nation, if they are to justify imposing on a large number of the young people of our country military conscription. We did not reach the question at that board meeting, well, does the present circumstance present a situation in which the government has not fulfilled the burden of proof? We expect that individual cases may come along where individuals may refuse, for instance, to go to Vietnam in particular, on the ground that they consider the conscription itself in what is formally peacetime to be a violation of their right, and we'll have to look at these individual cases as they come along and decide whether ACLU is going to go in to challenge the whole concept of conscription in America. We're particularly urging Congress to take a look in 1967 when the Draft Act comes up for readoption. A very careful look at the idea of the institutionalization of compulsory military service in America. On the right of objection to a particular war, here the problem is also very knotty, because how do you distinguish political opposition from a deeply felt moral conviction? How do you tell whether the individual who is saying, I simply cannot fight in this war because it so violates my deep sense of morality, that he is distinct in some way from the person who has a tactical or a strategic difference of opinion, say a General Gavin who is for the enclave's strategy, or someone else who has some other idea as to how the war should be waged? We think that those distinctions can be made, and that there is no justification. If the government is going to extend the privilege of conscientious objection to people who have religious convictions, there's no justification for not extending the same privilege to people who have a deeply felt moral conviction about a particular war. On the third question of the declaration of war, we did not feel that there is a constitutional question, perhaps, but not a civil liberties one, in our opinion. We think that more civil liberties problems would be raised by a formal declaration of war than would be resolved. There are various repressive actions which the government may take in formally declared wartime, such as the concentration camps for people who oppose the war, which may be established under our present law once war is declared, which the government cannot do without a declaration of war. We were in doubt as to exactly whom war should be declared against in the present circumstances, where what you really have is a revolution taking place in the country with foreign aid to it, to be sure. But unless the United States is going to invade and defeat the North Vietnamese and Chinese governments, which some people advocate we should, there doesn't seem to be a clearly defined enemy against whom war could be declared. So that on that one, we did not feel that there was any particular point from the point of view of defending freedom in America to insist that if you're going to fight, you better have a declaration of war. Those are the three aspects of the problem that we've been trying to deal with.
Now, the National Board of ACLU really wants to open this up to a national discussion, don't they? I mean, isn't this one reason for issuing this lengthy statement on these questions?
Yes, we want to discuss it ourselves, and we want a lot of other people discussing it. One of the problems in a tense situation, such as we have now politically in this country, is that people become more and more fearful to express themselves on these ideas because they feel that it may be undermining the government's policy. It may be giving heart and encouragement to those against whom the government is fighting, and it may affect the morale of our soldiers in Vietnam who are in dangerous conditions and are giving their lives, so that people are reluctant to speak out, and when they hear that those who have spoken out have suffered penalties, whether it be that draft boards are taking a new look at their draft status and reclassifying them to send them into the Army as a penalty, in a way, for their having spoken out, that there is a tendency for people to not think and not talk about their convictions. So that one of the reasons for issuing the statement at this time is that we have come to these conclusions and we would like everyone to feel free and open to debate them.
Here in Minnesota, Mr. Kastner will be promoting public discussion of this statement, certainly, and how will you go about that, Lynn?
Well, at the last board meeting, it was the statement taken by the National Board was reported to the Minnesota Board of Directors, and we were in the midst of our planning for a series of spring meetings on an important civil liberties topic. In the past years, they've been restricted to the Twin Cities area, but this year we have planned on having spring meetings in Duluth and in Fargo-Moorhead, where we have a new area committee. So it was decided that academic freedom and the right to dissent would be the topic, whereas part of our discussion we can devote some searching debate, stimulate debate and discussion about this question of conscription, academic freedom, the right to dissent, and the right to conscientiously object. We will be having a meeting in Duluth on Saturday afternoon at the Duluth Hotel. On April 2nd we'll be meeting in Fargo.
Gentlemen, I want to get into this question of whether any government, no matter what kind of government it is, democratic or otherwise, can allow the individual the kind of discretion that seems to be recommended here in the statement of the National ACLU Board. Doesn't this come directly into conflict with basic concerns about national security if we let each individual make up his mind as to what degree and how he will participate in national defense?
Well, in a sense, the recognition by our government since the First World War that there should be a special status for conscientious objectors settles that question. That is, obviously, it does mean that some people are not going to be drafted and others are, and the dividing line is going to be on some judgment as to the religious or moral or ethical beliefs of the individual. The government tried to do it the easy way, and simply to start out, they said, well, people who belong to established peace churches, to established religious communities who have a tradition of refusing to participate in all wars will be exempt and no one else. And that was about people who had political objections or even all kinds of ethical and other objections to the First World War simply spent their time in prison, and not a very pleasant time. There was a feeling in the First World War there was no recognition in America that there should be a right to conscientious objection, or there was only very imperfect recognition and no real legal sanction for it. People were taken into the military stockades and tortured and treated as slackers, as people who simply were afraid to fight. To press them into the military service, there were a lot of political objectors to the First World War, far more in this country than there were to the Second World War, on political grounds. People who felt that it was an imperialist war, there were pro-German people who felt that because of their traditional ties to Germany, they did not want to fight in the First World War. There were a lot of socialists who opposed the First World War and who did spend time, and anarchists who spent time in prison because they refused to be conscripted in the First World War. But once the government granted and institutionalized the right of a person or the privilege of a person not to serve in the armed forces, to take alternative service of some kind, because of his religious beliefs, it was simply an administrative convenience to confine this to the established peace churches, where you didn't have to judge the individual's depth of feeling, but a person who was brought up in a particular religious community, even though he personally may have had very mild or no feelings about this at all, it was just part of his family atmosphere, would be exempted, whereas a individual who had very deep felt beliefs on general war or on a specific war, but who didn't have this religious background, had a very tough time establishing his right to conscientious objection. It was only in the Seeger case, within the last couple of years, I believe, that the courts extended the right to people who did not have a deistic belief, a belief in God, which compelled them in their, as they see their religion, to refuse to fight, but said that if a person has deeply felt moral and ethical convictions, which in his life play the same role as that of a belief in God in the life of those who are religiously inclined, he should be given the same exemption, because the government cannot, under the First Amendment's Establishment Clause, distinguish between those who believe in God and those who have other similar beliefs. Now, I must admit, and certainly the ACLU was fully aware, that it is a difficult proposition to extend this to opposition to fighting in a particular war. At least the person who is not going to fight in any war can say, well, I'm just not going to kill, and I don't care how moral the war may be in some abstract sense, the very killing is immoral, and on those grounds I cannot participate. Here we're saying that a person can have the same kind of deep moral and ethical and social convictions about a particular war as he can about war in general, which may not extend in his feeling to all wars, but in this particular situation he may be convinced that his government is so immoral in its conduct that he will not support it. Now you very properly ask, well, can the government afford to permit that? Can the government let us all pick and choose those aspects of government policy in which we're going to play the game and those in which we're going to sit on the sidelines? Generally speaking, no. And the burden of proof is going to be very severe on the individual who is going to take this position. Before we will represent anyone, we must be convinced that this is a moral stand that he is taking, and it is not simply a reluctance to fight or to give up his freedom for 2 years. And he must be able to convince the courts that this is so. Actually, once the government has gone beyond the traditional church affiliation standard, they have opened the door to the idea that an individual can persuade his draft board or the courts that he does have these kinds of convictions, even though he has not had an association with an organized group necessarily. Even from the Seeger case, it isn't even clear that the court has gone that far so far. I believe that Seeger was able to show that he had had a long history of expressing this belief and of showing it in one way or another. Well, how about the individual who has recently come to these same convictions?
I was going to ask you about that. Pacifists have traditionally had to show a history of pacifism. The Vietnamese War or the Dominican intervention, these matters have only been of public concern for the last couple of years, and it would be very conceivable that one might, in fact, this prompts a question along this line, one might make a study of the facts involved in the Vietnamese War and come to the conclusion that this is a bad policy for the United States. Now, what I'm getting at here is, what is the difference in your mind here, or in the mind of the members of the board of ACLU, as to a political decision like this, where there might be considerable intellectual conviction behind it, that this is a bad policy for us to pursue, and Vietnam being just an example of it, as opposed to the person, and we do have these in our society certainly, who are sympathetic to the National Liberation Front and sincerely would prefer to see them win this war. Now, there are two different kinds of opposition. Do both of those come under consideration here?
Well, I would say they don't, although I would share with you the feeling that it is going to be difficult to determine. In other words, all that we were able to say at this point is that in principle, there is no difference between a deeply felt moral, social, ethical conviction about a particular war and general war. Obviously, the standard of proof is going to be far more difficult. The decision on what case ACLU is going to take is going to be far more difficult, mm-hmm. because in trying to take to set new law, as this would do if it is ever sustained by the courts, we would naturally want to pick a individual who, in our opinion, fulfills all the qualifications of what we're talking about. But I think it's very hard to contest the idea that although it will be difficult to know where to draw the line between simply a general political opposition, a support to the other side in the war, or a deeply felt moral conviction, that a person, in my opinion, can be as deeply convinced of his political views as he is of general moral standards. It's hard to draw those lines. We are going to try to draw them and to persuade the court that in this, that, or the other case they can. Now, we don't think that this confronts the government with the danger that thousands of young people, or tens of thousands of young people, are going to say, well, this is the way we feel about it, and therefore you must exempt us. The young people themselves have got to recognize that if they are going to claim this exemption, they must be ready to stand the severest test of what their conscience and what their convictions are. I think it does discriminate against the inarticulate, and for the articulate, a person who has a deep feeling but doesn't know exactly why, he just feels that way, will find it very hard to persuade us or to persuade the court that he falls in this category. And in a sense, one can say that one has to have, to be able to understand, if one's going to talk about the right to conscientious objection to a particular war, to have a pretty sophisticated understanding of why one objects to this war, to qualify under that. None of us like to go and fight in jungles and expose ourselves to death. I'm sure that most of the men in Vietnam right now, if they simply had a free choice, although many of them have volunteered for this service, they get extra pay, and some people, I suppose, enjoy it. But there are relatively few, I would think, in our society who just love to fight. For all of them, they would like to opt out. We don't propose that that we are now saying that in a democratic society, everyone just has a right to decide for himself when he plays the game and when he doesn't. We're saying that when the democratic society, having gone through the democratic process, has come to a decision, generally speaking, it is part of democracy for even the opponents of that decision to go along with it. We're saying that only in those instances where the person feels that this decision is so contrary to his basic moral beliefs that he is willing, in effect, to go to prison if the decision should go against him, rather than to go here, and that seems to me will be a pretty sharp dividing line. We would not want to urge any young man to tread this road lightly and to come to us for help if he isn't willing to go all the way and that to prove his moral conviction by the willingness, if we should not succeed in the courts, to take the penalty rather than to simply say, well, even though I feel this way, I will go into the army. And that's one of the problems that the traditional peace organizations in America are very disturbed and very worried about. A lot of young people who are now filing conscientious objection papers who have not thought this through fully. They just don't like the war in Vietnam. They've been demonstrating against it, and some of them don't have very serious convictions about it. But it's sort of, they've been told by some of the groups involved in opposition to Vietnam that, well, just file for conscientious objection. It takes a long time for them to process the appeals and so forth, and this is one way of opposing the war in Vietnam. I think that is immoral, to propose to people that they make, for the real conscientious objector, whether to general war or to a particular war, they make his road all the harder if they're gumming up the procedures of the conscientious objection when they're not really objectors and aren't willing to take the penalty for their convictions.
Seems to me that there is some overlapping here between political objection and moral objection that would make it very difficult for a court or for a board, for that matter, to decide what is conscientious or based on conscience and what isn't. And still not be a matter of just strategic objections to war. In other words, people could genuinely feel that we ought to go into one country and deliberately try to topple the government, let's say the Trujillo regime in the Dominican Republic, in which we participated in the overthrow there, whereas they could conscientiously, I should think, oppose what the United States is doing in Vietnam and do it conscientiously. Now, I don't see here where you can separate what would be a political concern or a political objection to United States policy from a moral or conscientious objection. And will the court have to make some decision along the way, make some criterion here, or what?
Well, I think the court has already, given the, in their Tarasco and Seeger decisions, given enough of a guideline to separate political from a moral or belief in conscience. We've been asked, and I think we'll be we will be asked again, how does ACLU plan to draw a line between a political and a and a conscience objection? That's really not a fair question, because we don't decide whether a belief is political or whether it's one of conscience. The court has set up a test, and it's difficult not just for this area, but court tests in many areas are difficult. In the Seeger case, they face the question of whether a person with a humanistic or ethical belief qualified for the statutory exemption for belief in or a right of conscience. And there the court said the test of belief is whether a given belief that is sincere and meaningful occupies a place in the life of its possessor parallel to that filled by the orthodox belief in God of one who clearly qualifies for the exemption. Now this is the test, but how is it applied? As Mr. Haskell has pointed out, there are a series of steps that a conscientious objector has to go through and a series of procedures that have to be fulfilled to meet the test, even with a clearly religious objection. The background information has to be given. Papers have to be filled out. The draft board looks into a man's personal family and other background. The Justice Department makes an investigation. And there's as much a difficulty in the religious belief or the humanistic exemption of Seeger in finding out whether a belief is sincere and meaningful as there is in determining whether a person just has a political objection to the war or whether his objection to Vietnam or any other particular conflict is one of conscience or one of real moral force.
There seems to be a change in American attitudes to a great extent in that it is now, it seems to me, generally thought that a young man has a duty to give 2, 3, or 4 years of his young life around the college years to his country in military and serving in the military armed services. Yet the ACLU has said that military conscription, quote, is always a severe deprivation of civil liberties, which is warranted only by the overriding need of national security. Now, isn't there some conflict here between what Americans, I think, generally accept, that is, the concept of duty of every young man, and what you say here is a basic deprivation of liberty?
Well, if Americans really believe that every young person should give 2 or 3 years of his life to some form of service for his government, this would be a change in our concept of the idea that people should be pretty much free to find their own vocation in life and that the government can ask them for part of their income but not part of their lives. The only justification that the government has put forth for this concept has been that we're imminently in peril, that the world is in turmoil, and that the United States must have this for military purposes only. I grew up as a young boy in Bulgaria, where there were two types of service which everyone had to give to his government. One was in a labor corps, and the other was in the army. There were additional types of service. For instance, the citizens of my town had to put in several days working on the roads. This is a poor country. They did not have our billions of dollars for highway construction, and so people had to go and, with hammer in hand, break up rocks and make these macadam roads that they had, and this was considered part of the citizen's service. In the schools, school children went out and seeded seedlings in the hills as part of the reforestation program, and this was considered part of their service to their society and to their government. I don't think there's any contradiction between a democratic concept and saying that every citizen should give some of his life to government if we want to really apply it across the board. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you need a military justification for it if you want to say that this is a better way to imbue civic consciousness in the individual and his responsibility to society, the society which nurtures him and within which he makes his living and makes his life. I understand that as an acceptable aspect of democracy, but I don't think that we can say that we've reached that point in American life at all. What we say is there's no doubt that when people are taken into the military service, and the fact is that only a small fraction of the total population is required to serve today, there's no doubt that they are deprived of the kinds of privileges and rights and immunities that other citizens who aren't taken in have. There's no doubt that in the armed forces there is a severe restriction of one's freedom of speech, freedom of movement, all freedoms, and the freedom to get out, for one thing, which most of us find that we are free to leave an occupation if we find it utterly unsatisfactory, whereas the soldier is not. He has to serve for a set period of time, whether he enlists voluntarily or whether he is a conscript. Now, what we are saying here is that to justify this kind of service and this kind of sacrifice, from a small percentage of the young men of the country, or from everybody. Incidentally, if we're going to extend the idea of service to the nation, women should be no more exempt than men from that kind of service.
We shouldn't discriminate.
No, we should not discriminate. What we have said is that first we must be sure that this really is equitably applied to everyone. The fact is that our young people who go to college are a privileged group at the present time, because many of them end up by not serving at all. There is no particular justice that I can see that a person who cannot afford or is not qualified for a college education must serve, whereas a boy who's going to college can postpone it indefinitely and possibly wiggle out altogether, because then he will go into a protected profession or something of that sort. So we have always thought that the draft should be applied impartially as to class, as to color, and any other differences that the population has. But what we are saying is that if we are going to do it at all, there must be an overriding national, not just a importance, but really the country should not be able to get along without it, and that the burden of proof is on the government to keep on justifying to the American people the invasion of the lives of a small number of them, or of all of them, by requiring military service. So I don't think really that we have sort of gotten into the habit in 25 years of accepting the draft. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't re-examine it very carefully from time to time. I don't think that countries who have military conscription, I don't think that the military service is, generally speaking, a positive educational experience for democracy. It is true that many young men have found themselves in the military service, that for many Negroes, I don't think that we would have the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s if we had not had conscription of Negroes in the Second World War. Hundreds of thousands of young men were taken out of the rural communities where they had accepted segregation and discrimination. They saw that there was a different way of life in the countries to which they were taken. They were asked to perform highly skilled and highly dangerous occupations, and when they came back, they were not willing to accept the way of life which they had before. And in that sense, I think the Second World War performed a great educational democratic service for the American people. Generally speaking, though, I think educators would agree that a system in which giving orders and taking orders is a prime requisite for successful performance, rather than one in which the individual is asked to make judgments and to participate in the decision-making process. And that, in the Army, it is of the nature of the Army that there is very limited participation of the ranks in deciding on policy. Very, very limited. And the good soldier is the one who takes orders and passes orders down and so on. So that I don't think that one can justify it on educational grounds. I think that it is a very dangerous weapon. Socially speaking, from the point of view of the ultimate democratic development of our society. So the government has got to have the burden of proof that it is necessary. And we certainly don't take the position that there is no circumstance in which the citizen should sacrifice his personal welfare to the common good. We think that there are circumstances in which it is part of the duty of citizenship in a democracy that we all make sacrifices to the common welfare. So that all we're saying is that the government has got to keep on proving to the American people, and there should be free and open debate on this issue constantly to re-examine whether the circumstances at any particular time justify it.
Before our time gets away, I would like to get into the question of the undeclared war, too. Senator Wayne Morse, who before entering the Senate was dean of the University of Oregon Law School, has raised serious questions repeatedly in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings about sending young men to Vietnam without a declaration of war by the Congress of the United States. He challenged attorneys to dispute him on this, and I believe a section, or else the American Bar Association, did take a position that the United States was within its rights to send men into Vietnam without a formal declaration of war. They contradicted Senator Morse's statement in any case. What has ACLU said about this question?
We have said that this may be a grave constitutional question, but we don't think that it's one which is civil liberties. Now, not all constitutional matters are ones which relate to democratic decision and democratic participation in society. And not all civil liberties questions are constitutional, incidentally. We believe that There is a general idea of civil liberties in which the Constitution itself is rooted and our rights are rooted, which is a little more than what is written down there, and that's why we're always asking the court to reinterpret the Constitution in the light of society's present understanding of what democracy really means. We have taken the position that at the present time we don't see, we believe that there has been opportunity for debate, although it has been restricted by various forms of opposition and repression, and that there is no ground to believe, for instance, that if the president sought a declaration of war, he would not get it. That is, we cannot say that this war is being wielded by a dictator who is not subject to congressional approval. He has to get his appropriations from Congress. There may be all kinds of pressures on congressmen to vote those appropriations which have little to do with the war in Vietnam, but the fact is that it seems that there are more people and more congressmen who favor the government's policy than there are who are against it. So what we have said, however, is that if anyone is prosecuted for a crime which only a valid declaration of war can make a crime, we would take up his defense on those grounds. For instance, if there should be a prosecution for treason for someone who says or gives some kind of support to the Viet Cong at the present time, treason is a carefully defined crime in American law, and we would be willing to defend him on the ground that the government can't have it both ways, both have sort of an informal war and yet apply the formal restrictions to the citizens, which could apply only if they are going to declare war. But we don't think that there would be any gain to civil liberties by compelling, and I think Senator Morse found out the other day that there wasn't any great gain by trying to get Congress to revoke the Tonkin Gulf resolution, to sort of insist on the formality. In this case, we don't think the formality relates to the substance of democracy and to what really determines American foreign policy. So we are not proposing a general attack, legislative or judicial. I can't imagine a court deciding that somebody should not serve because there isn't a declared war, and that only in the case of a declared war do any of the compulsions to service apply. I can't imagine it, although sometimes the Supreme Court is ahead of the American Civil Liberties Union, strangely enough, and we...
At the beginning of our program, I quoted a statement from former President Kennedy in which he implied that the status of the conscientious objector in our society would have to become somewhat greater, and the prestige connected with opposition to war would have to become somewhat greater before a viable system of world law or a consensus on rule of law could develop in the world. Gentlemen, I am going to ask you if the use of the draft laws in the United States to punish people who protest the war in Vietnam or who object to the system of conscription is serious in your minds concerning the respect that the individual citizen has for the institution of law in this country. Is it important that citizens respect individual laws such as the draft laws in terms of their feeling of identification and of participation in our society? In other words, is the draft law in any sense alienating people in the United States today, especially people of draft age?
Well, Mr. Granger, I don't think there is any group of citizens who are more concerned with the law and the abiding by the law and the respect for law than the American Civil Liberties Union is. If we could not go to the courts to interpret the law and to apply it, we would not be able to do our job at all. The big objection we have had to the tendency of draft boards to punish young people who have protested or have engaged in protests by changing the draft classifications does relate to this. There is no doubt that no one conceived the draft as a punishment for political views. It was regarded, and every part of the legislative history of the draft laws in America shows that it was regarded as a national necessity, and now we have had instances where draft boards have reclassified people very obviously because of a vindictive feeling that they are going to punish them for expressing their views on this particular war. We have tried to remonstrate with General Hershey, the head of the Selective Service, to urge him, since he had made some statements which could be interpreted by draft boards as sanctioning this, to urge him to make very clear to the draft boards, of which are made up of volunteer civilians across the country, that the draft may not be used to punish people. He denies that there is any implication that it can so be used, and says that in cases where people have been reclassified, it is simply that their conditions have changed. If they have been arrested and convicted, as a group of University of Michigan students were at Ann Arbor for sitting in at a draft board, well, if they're going to have to spend some time in the Hoosgow, they're not going to be students. So that leads to a reclassification. We think since the Selective Service head of the state of Michigan reopened their cases before they were convicted, before there was judicial recognition of any chance even that they would go to jail, and haven't gone to jail, and they've been conducting their studies as they had before, they're on appeal at the present time, that this was obviously an attempt to use the draft law, and that even though that unless the president and the head of Selective Service makes it very plain to the draft boards across the country that Selective Service is not going to be used as a political punishment, there certainly will be a growing disrespect for the draft law and a feeling by young people that any means of frustrating a law which is being used illegally, in a sense, against them is legitimate. There is nothing more destructive to a democratic society, I think, than a growing conviction of the citizens that the laws are not the rules of society for conduct, which we all must abide by, but that they are being used to punish, to discriminate, and to serve purposes other than those of the regulation of a ordered society. And so I think that the question is a very good one, and I think that the government should be the first one to be concerned, not to spread the fact or the illusion or the conviction among people that now the enlistment of people or the drafting of people into the armed forces is going to be used to suppress the discussion and the opposition, the vocal opposition to the policies of the government. Once in the army, it is clear that a soldier has far less opportunity to express his views, his political views, than outside. The case of Lieutenant Howe in El Paso, Texas, who, while off duty and in civilian clothes, participated in an anti-Vietnam War demonstration and has been convicted by a court-martial to a very severe penalty for doing so. We are appealing his case, and we hope that the courts are going to say that at least out of the front lines, out of the theater of war, soldiers do have a right to express their political views, not as soldiers, but as citizens of the country. We hope that the courts will sustain that point of view and that we will get a reversal of Lieutenant Howe's conviction. But this illustrates one of the reasons for the growing alienation of sectors of our young people from our society, and a feeling that our society is conspiring to constrain them and to force a conformity upon them. There is nothing about law in an ordered society which should make people feel that way if the laws are conscientiously and legally, so to speak, applied.
I can't help think of Senator Morse's concern on the international level about the same question. He said if the United States is going to be the leader in terms of the stone-by-stone building of a system of international law and of respect for law, that the United States ought to, in his terms, abide by the rules of international law in its conduct of the war in Vietnam. This would raise questions that are different, but certainly related to this basic concern for the respect for law, both within the United States and of the United States ideals in the eyes of the people of the world. I want to thank both of you, Gordon Haskell, the Membership and Development Director of the National American Civil Liberties Union, and Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, for being with us this afternoon.
That was Marvin Granger interviewing Gordon Haskell and myself on conscientious objection to a particular war, the National ACLU position recently released. If you would like a printed copy of the American Civil Liberties Union position on these war questions, send your name and address to MCLU, 925 Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's MCLU, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. We invite your comments and questions. This has been an educational production of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union.